Hello, I'm Tina Marie St. Cyr, and welcome to Light Your Life, the podcast. I believe our dreams have energy, calling, and purpose, and that when we move in their direction, our lives become even more joyful, fulfilled, and effortless. This podcast gives you insights to the strategies our guests use to overcome obstacles and manifest their dreams in business, career, relationships, and in life. Listen to find new levels of energy, perspective, and courage. Your journey to light your life begins now. Hello and welcome. I'm so glad that we are together again. This is Tina Marie, and thank you for joining. It's going to be a wonderful time. Thank you for sharing your time and your mindset of allowing the words and the wisdom of our guests today to come into our understanding. And that way we can take who we are and what we are and become even better. That's why we're here. That's why we listen to podcasts. So thank you for listening. It's going to be a great conversation. My guest today is Dr. Scott Massey. He's a PhD, an educator. He's been 30 years in university and teaching and engaging and evoking and evolving minds. And that's a wonderful story in and of itself. However, the conversation I'd love for us to have today and the connection is around a topic that is not so easily spoken about. And it's so dear to my heart and the experience that I've had within my family unit. And I'm believing it's going to touch you too. And it's the topic of sobriety. And of course, with sobriety comes the previous experience of addictions. And so no matter where you are, and if this touches home in any way, I guarantee that what we're going to be talking about together today is going to help you become a better person, because you know people that have addiction issues, even if we're not speaking about it, which I'm hoping over the next, you know, generations, we become so much more enthralled with really being humble and to show people that this is a real experience that we need to have a conversation about. It can hit home for you too. So here we go. We're just going to have a wonderful conversation. And, Mr. Scott's going to share his story. And I know whenever we hear somebody's story, it touches home in many different levels. So Dr. Scott Massey, thank you so much for being here and being willing to share your story. I know you and I connected deeply. And I said, I'd love to have like a chat so that other people can also be in what we experienced in a conversation and do that again. Right. Sounds great.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Tina Marie. And it's my honor to be on your podcast.
You're so sweet. So sobriety, you know, it comes, like I said, with that previous experience of our lives where addiction was sometimes a friend, a very dear friend, that becomes a coping mechanism to heal previous traumas or pains or ways of being that we did not know how to cope with in a healthy way. So where would you love to start? How do we unpack this understanding of sobriety and addiction? What could you start us with?
Sure. I think to unpack my story, I really have to begin when it began for me. I took my first drink when I was 12 years old. Mm. And I believe that the moment I took my first drink, I became an alcoholic, because throughout my life, up until the age of 41, actually, I continued to drink on a regular basis, many times quite heavily. So it wasn't until I finally made that decision to achieve sobriety that alcohol continued to be, like you mentioned, was it a good friend or was it an enemy? I think for the most part, I was deceiving myself many times during those years that it was something good, but rather it was something that was always chipping away at my foundation.
Help me understand the Scott that was 12 years old. And thank you for sharing that. Yeah. I've worked with other individuals, professionals, executives, CEOs, general counsels of Fortune 100 companies. And when we get to a real, you know, connection, they will say things of that nature, that they either started drinking or using drugs at a very young age prior to the age of 13. So it's not uncommon for us. And what was real in your life at that age that had you even consider that a drink was a possibility?
I think I have to go back to through, you know, that part of my life, I dealt with some pretty bad self-esteem issues, and I wanted to be accepted. And so the culture during that time, you know, it's the early 1970s, was that drinking was pretty acceptable. Now, my parents both drank heavily, so it didn't seem like a big stretch for me to reach behind our bar at home and mm-hmm. pull out a bottle of brandy. And one of mm-hmm. my friends just said, you know, let's drink it. And when I drank the first time, and I drank about probably a pint of brandy straight.
Whoa. That's a lot. Oh my goodness gracious.
I still remember that sensation of that burning sensation going down, mm-hmm. you know, into my stomach. And for the first time since I could remember at that time, I felt confident. It was like, whoa, this is like the elixir of truth for me. I think when it hit my brain, it was like, this is the answer, because, mm-hmm. you know, experiencing anxiety so much, you know, during a lot of my life, actually. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I also experienced some depression issues as well. It was like that gave me all of a sudden a sense of well-being. So that was kind of like the story behind it. And, you know, after that, I don't think that until, you know, or at least during the teenage years, I drank probably at least weekly, if not more. I also used marijuana pretty heavily as a teenager as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that. And was it something that your family knew was happening, or was this something you were hiding from people?
Well, I hid it pretty well. My parents figured it out after a time when they saw me coming out of a bar with a case of beer when I was 15. You know, I hid it pretty well. And I'd say that through most of my life, I hid it quite well. And I mean, I spent, you know, again, from age 12 until age 41, essentially an alcoholic, functioning or not. But it was something that I did not want people to know.
Isn't it interesting that we hide things, right? Because don't we know that they are wrong? Mm-hmm. So it's like a little bit of a double-edged sword. We hide that, which yep. is something we want, yep. and it's working for us. It's working for us. It's working for us at some level, yet we know that it's wrong for us. And it seems to give a little bit of an energy of, it's crazy enough, aliveness to yeah. get away with hiding things.
Yeah. And you know, being such an introvert and also, you know, just being quite shy. I mean, mm-hmm. even though I've been in front of people for many years, mm-hmm. I'm at the depth of the depth of my core. I'm a shy person. And alcohol gave me that bravado. I mean, I was like, whoa, now I can, like, you know, talk to anybody. Now I'm great. And, you know, even though I probably didn't act very good, I mean, I probably acted really stupid sometimes. Mm-hmm. In my mind, I was like in control all the time. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah. And you mentioned the word functional, because there is a term. You and I both come from a background. My mother was an alcoholic, and her drug abuse, in addition to that, was with pharmaceutical drugs. And so her drug dealer was her doctor. And she, a beautiful soul, a wonderful woman, very powerful, yet also those traumas from the past, the places where she did not feel powerful, she utilized the crutch of alcohol to be mm-hmm. like her superhero cape, right? Yeah. And it's easy to not think about the pain of the past or the present if it's subdued by alcohol, or in her case, also prescription meds. And then my father was, he was the alcoholic that would buy everybody a drink. He was the best friend of the neighborhood. And he was functional. So my mother wasn't so functional. And I remember seeing her in ways that were, you know, painful for me to witness. Yet my father, being a functional drunk, he would keep it social. So Friday nights or Saturday nights, and then a couple drinks or beers before bed, but often to excess in the quietness of our family home, and never in the place where his employer could see it. So, or, you know, anyone that he really cared to continue to respect him, right? He would hide it from them. So is that what it means by being a functional addict?
Yeah. And let me, two things I want to say is that one's my parents were both, you know, functional alcoholics as well. Mm-hmm. And they worked all their lives, but alcohol was an integral part of their lives, daily drinking. Now for me, I was in the professional world, you know, so I was in the medical profession. I was also in education. So for anybody to know that I had a drinking issue was mm-hmm. taboo. And so I drank alone. And in my mind, I thought, I have perfect control over this. And, you know, it was really common for me to be in bars by myself drinking. That was normal behavior for me for many years. But I think that the key thing about functional alcoholics is they don't, you know, and myself, I didn't realize how eventually I started losing grip of control, and it became apparent to everyone. But I didn't realize that though. So I think that the functional component oftentimes is not probably as secretive as people think.
Right. It takes courage for the people around us to bring it to our attention and to approach us mm-hmm. and to ask, you know, hey, what's really going on? And what I find is, you know, so I'm a member of what's known as Al-Anon. And so I'm one of those wonderful enablers, have been. So I've worked on this many, many years. And then I'm also what's known as ACA, which is an adult child of alcoholics. And when I finally found that 12-step program and did the assessments, everybody has an assessment. When I did that, it hit home. I mean, it hit my soul. I went, ah, crap, this is it. This is it. And it was just good to not be alone in the journey. That's what we're talking about this today. So hopefully, you know, you're still here with us and you understand that, hey, I need to listen to this. I really need to listen to this. Because once I understand how I work, then I can understand the coupling that I attracted addicts into my experience, because it became almost like the fit of a puzzle piece. And, then I could have awareness about it. And so when was your awareness? I can tell that there was pain. And of course, we could dive into the different stories of how painful your addiction to alcohol was, you know, and anybody here that is with us is, you know, if addiction is part of your life. And whenever you and I met, Scott, I said that I believe in my heart of hearts that everyone has an addiction. They just, if they know it, they're working it. They're working on it. If they don't know it, they haven't known how to work on it yet. So we're having this beautiful conversation to help us, because I believe addiction in the human experience is a pathway to our genius, a pathway to our greatness, a pathway to our soul, and a pathway to our spirit. And I believe it's been placed in family units and life journeys on purpose to not keep us down, yet to evoke us into another level. And so when did you start to know for yourself? Because it can only be you having the awareness of you, yeah. not other people knocking on you to say, hey, you got a problem. When did you start making that understanding?
I think it was the confrontation of some people around me that cared about me. I mean, I have a really dear friend, his name is Paul, and he confronted me probably 3 years before I made the decision to become sober and said, you've got a problem. And I reacted with anger. My brother, who also has been in recovery for many years, confronted me and told me that I have a problem as well. And then also some coworkers. I mean, and I think that even though I reacted, say, no, I don't have a problem, and defensively, I started to see it started to dawn on me that I do have a serious problem, but then things happened that really frightened me. I started getting blackouts, and blackouts are, for those that have experienced that, is that you don't know what you did. You wake up and you have no recollection. They actually began early on in my late teens, and they occurred off and on, but they started to increase their frequency. And then the DOI occurred, okay? And I think that those things, and then the loss, potential loss of my career was looming.
And so, what's a DOI, so people understand what a DOI is?
I was stopped. I was stopped intoxicated, and you know, I had a driving under the influence. And you know, I found myself in jail for 2 days, and you know, I was lucky I didn't have more than that, because you know, and here's something I'm going to tell anyone wants to hear this, is that I drove drunk many times, and it's only by the grace of God that I didn't kill myself or someone else. And I still think about that to this day, how somehow there was, you know, a reason that that didn't happen. But
thank God.
All those things, you know, and again, this gradually led up to the decision that, you know, we'll be talking about. But it took time. It took, you know, about a 3-year period of time. It's like, oh boy, but even in spite of that, my drinking accelerated the last 3 years.
Why do you think that is? Why did it accelerate?
Because I believe that alcoholics start reaching a bottom, but it's a disease. Mm-hmm. It's a disease in which more and more alcohol is required to get the same feeling. Yeah. And I mean, I think I was pretty much a daily drinker for many years, but what became 4 drinks became 8 drinks, became 12 drinks. And at the end, I was probably drinking the equivalent of at least 12 drinks a day. And in my mind, I thought, well, I have no problem because I wait until 5 o'clock. Between 5 o'clock and 11 o'clock, it was at least 12 drinks.
Wow. I'm glad you're still with us. And I am also glad that you didn't harm anybody in the process.
Yes.
Just this past weekend, I got word that a dear friend, her husband was coming home on one of the freeways here in Houston at and after work, and his car was struck by a drunk driver and he was killed.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, the drunk driver lived and had just scratches on him. And so I know he's on a different journey right now. But, you know, we hear these stories and other stories where, you know, loved ones can even, you know, it gets to the place where this demon, I call it a demon, that it subdues our thinking and our higher power, and it subdues our brilliance in our life and that which we were gifted with in a lifetime here. And I see it as an evil demon or set of demons that come in and take up residence in the psyche and the spirit. And if not thwarted, if not attacked and battled, will stay there for a long time, if not the entire lifetime of a person. And that's pain for me. It's definitely something that, you know, with all due respect and my own friendship, it pisses me off that we even have this ability to have to deal with this, right? So give us some wisdom on, you know, how did you usurp this? What was the process like for you? I mean, you had friends calling you out on it, but it's ultimately your decision to take action.
Yeah. You know, and I'll walk you right through that. And I remember the exact time. It was January the 5th, 2002. And I woke up that morning. And, you know, to not go into the gory details, I'll tell you a couple things. One is that I didn't remember where I was the night before. I had fallen and I had a head wound. And when I looked at myself that morning, what I saw and what I had become, it horrified me. But also I heard a definite voice whispered in my ear. It said, "Stop drinking or die." And that jolted me like metaphorically like a lightning bolt.
Right.
But that entire day I fought with myself. Oh no, I can't do it. Oh no, I can't do it. I can't do it. And it was with every inch of my being that I fought against it. But then I finally, by that night, I took the action to check myself in. And actually went to the hospital and checked myself in and voluntarily requested entry into treatment. And that was the beginning. I mean, that was the first step, but it took a conscious step. It took a decision, and again, in any kind of like, you know, aspiration or vision of doing something like that, the painful steps was the hard thing. Because I was walking into the unknown, and someone who had been drinking almost steadily since the age of 12 was now needing to stop drinking for the rest of my life.
Wow. And how old were you at that point?
I was 42.
42. Yeah. Long journey, huh?
Yes.
Did you believe you could do it?
No.
Was there a part of you that believed? No.
I didn't think I could do it. At that moment, I didn't think I could do it. I think it took a series of small baby steps. But I went in with the full intent that I was going to do it. Mm-hmm. And, I think, you know, as I began to sober up, and again, because I was so addicted to alcohol, I went, you know, I actually had withdrawal symptoms and I had to be medically treated. And it wasn't until day four that they transferred me into rehab. By that time, I had enough mental clarity to begin to conceptualize what I had ahead of me, that then I believed that I could. But at that point, I couldn't even think straight.
Thank you for sharing this so much. So we're at this place following you in your journey. I would have to think that the day that you're saying I'm checking myself in, you have other responsibilities in your life. There's a career. There were people, I believe, that were depending on you, probably financially. And you're now going to go into an unknown and step out of that life that you had built or believed it was part of your identity. What was that like? What was that fear like, saying, I've got to leave behind something and not know what the future looks like?
Yeah, good question. I was very fortunate that I had an employer that was very understanding and actually continued to pay me and actually gave me the leave. So that was that was a blessing. Mm-hmm. My son, I think at that time, had been disappointed many times because of my behavior. And at that time, he was trying to think how old he was then. He was about the age of, I think, 16. Mm-hmm. I will tell you that when an individual leaves the world of addiction and the world of alcoholism, you have to give something up. And for me, it was giving up every person that was associated with that part of my life had to go, and they all drifted away. And you, at the end of the day, you face it alone for the most part. But my family was very supportive from afar, very proud that I took the step. Mm-hmm. But it is a monumental shift, because the way that you were dealing with stress, the way that you were dealing with everything, was partially fueled by alcohol. And now you had to find the coping mechanisms to be able to now, address stress and various things. And that's where the most difficult part of that was. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, going into treatment is the first step. Maybe the easiest. Remaining sober is the most difficult.
Mm, congratulations. How many years have you been sober now?
19.
Congratulations. When's your birthday?
Actually, it would be January, this coming January the 5th. It'll be 20 years.
January 5th, 20 years coming up.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'll send you a celebration for your new chip.
Thank you.
Right? Right? And so this is a story of the soul. You know, it's easy for us as a culture, and I see this play out so many times. I remember the first time I went to a meeting. So I had a friend, I was a business owner with my husband at the time. And you know, like you do, you know, you come in on Monday and people ask, well, how was your weekend? Well, it was one of those weekends where it wasn't so great. So in our family unit, we dealt with alcoholism. We dealt with the conflict and the arguments and the avoidance and the eggshells that alcoholism and drug abuse, really engulf a family in. And as the enabler at that time, I was doing everything I can could mask it. I was the one that made it all look good. We were in the big five room, you know, big home in the prestigious neighborhood, driving the Lexuses and the Suburbans, and the kids are going to the great school, and I felt awful. I was miserable. I did not know how to get my, you know, I'd given vows for better or for worse, and I never knew the for worse could get so bad. And so I was blaming myself. Like, if I were a better wife, this wouldn't be part of the experience. If I were a better friend, if I knew how to have conversations and not trigger my husband, then things would be better. And I was burdening myself with this inner story of fix me so that I could fix him, and not knowing that was my disease. And so Monday morning at the office, not wanting to be disrespectful because my husband and I own the business, and these employees are his too. This particular person could see that I was struggling. And she asked me in confidence, she said, "Are you okay?" And I said, when you don't answer that question, people know that there's something else underneath that. And so she could see that my now ex was having an alcohol problem. She said that she'd found a bottle within his drawer at the in his desk at the office. And so it was evident that things were, that was the third party in our relationship was alcohol. I always called his alcohol usage his mistress. Mm-hmm. And so Phyllis was her name. And Phyllis said, "Can you go with me to a meeting? Can you just attend this meeting with me? And all you need to do is sit there and listen. You don't need to say anything." And I went to an AA meeting, and I listened, and I was like, "Oh crap, this is my story too." And then they gave me pamphlets and educational materials. This is long before anything digital. And she said, I encourage you to go to an Al-Anon meeting." Whenever I went to that meeting, I realized that my disease was half of the equation in our household, and I could only work on me. I could only change me. And I dedicated that not only for, it was primarily for my children, our children, so that we would, you know, at some level try and heal the ancestral, you know, lineage of these diseases that were being passed through our family units. And then also for me, because I believe deep down that I needed to find my own happiness before anybody else could be happy. And one of the mantras that I tell myself and I tell my students is, you know, happiness, your own happiness is the greatest gift you can give anyone. And so, I congratulate you on your journey. Help us know the benefits. And benefits just sounds like so cliche of a word. What's life been like for you, Scott, since you've been sober? I know it's a journey to get to this place. Take us to a life now. Who are you now? Who do you know yourself to be in this new light, right? This freedom.
Yeah. Thank you for asking. And I think it came with stages. The first couple of years, I mean, I had to do very, very hard work. And I had to go through a fair amount of therapy to be able to kind of unpack, you know, what had happened, because, you know, I had to not undo, but I had to learn how to, shift my inner framework, more or less. But once I got through that process, I will say that my life has been blessed beyond belief. And again, not just from a professional viewpoint, because I've certainly experienced considerable success during my journey. Mm-hmm. But the richness of my life. And I remember a moment in time about a year in when I was walking and I was looking up at the sky. And I was looking and I was listening to all, you know, like nature, the birds. And I was like, I don't think that I've really seen it like that for many years. And it was like the small things, the sun on my face, you know, things like that. So, the sobriety has blessed me throughout my life, my journey now. And it's allowed me to be a better version of me. And I think also it has set me on a path to continuously improve myself too. I realized that I can be better the next step. I can be better. And prior to sobriety, I had no awareness of that. I had no awareness that anything was possible, but now I believe it is.
That's awesome. So it sounds like you came online, right? Yeah. You became an online human that.
Yeah.
You're working with all your faculties now.
I also want to share to your audience too that sobriety has been an enormous gift to me, but it also comes with daily affirmations and daily decisions. I mean, mm-hmm. During those 19 plus years, I could have relapsed thousands of times, mm-hmm. but one thing that I have done is I'm able to call myself back to how I felt that day and some of the things that happened, but I referenced that voice whatever that might have been, mm-hmm. but I remember that experience of where I was, and nothing in my mind, nothing would allow me to take that drink to go back there. It's, mm-hmm. it was like I had a rare, I guess, opportunity to right my ship, and I was able to do that. But it also takes that constant work. You have to keep working at it. You know, I've gone to meetings. Mm-hmm. If I have any cravings, I go to, I have to go to a meeting, because you, mm-hmm. you have to stay on top of it. So the work, which is, you just get better and better with that, is part of it though. You know, mm-hmm. if it's not, then unfortunately people are not successful. And I will say this, and this is a sad thing I'll share with you. I went through rehab with a number of gentlemen that became friends of mine. I think there were seven of them, and I was the only one that remained sober, and two of them were dead within 2 years.
Oh, wow.
So I feel like I was fortunate, but I was able to tap into the inner strength that I had to be able to mm-hmm. overcome that.
Yeah. So sorry about those losses. And it's real. It's a real journey that we have as humans every single day here. And it's going to be with us. I mean, it's not like this habit of going toward the addictions, whatever substance it is, your addiction of choice, as they say, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of them. There's a litany.
Yeah.
There's a litany of addictions, be it alcohol, which is the most common that people could talk about, drug usage. And, even today, whenever I work with the youth, sometimes I work with young males or young females, and we have an intake process, and they say, one of it is, are you utilizing any substances? And we have a whole list, a checkbox, on a daily basis, weekly basis, monthly basis, and which one they check. Oftentimes they're checking marijuana. Mm-hmm. And, marijuana, whenever I was growing up in high school, was known as the gateway drug, because it allows you to subdue your higher reasoning and, just say everything's okay. And, give you that opening to, what the hell, let's just mm-hmm. do all this stuff. So I know it's another discussion that we could have. Did you find that marijuana was that for you to just, subdue any reasoning?
Yeah. I mean, I started using marijuana at the age of 13, and it wasn't the only reason, but I ended up dropping out of high school at age 15. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the reasons that I did is because I just had no motivation, and marijuana will sap away that motivation, mm-hmm. And for me, mixing alcohol and marijuana were really bad combinations, but it didn't result in me going to heroin or cocaine, et cetera, but it definitely fueled the two together.
So. Yeah. And it's a common thing right now. I mean, it's more accepted now than I think it ever has been. Mm-hmm. And it's more readily acceptable, and we're on probably the eve of marijuana being legalized across the United States, right?
Yes.
So that's going to be a whole nother conversation of what we do as a human population to reach into who do we truly want to be and how do we want to live? Because there's so much creation we have inside of ourselves to bring to bear, and so much greatness we can have, and healing we can have, and innovation we can have, that if subdued by alcohol or marijuana or drugs of, you know, whatever the choice is, then we're not reaching. I mean, you know, yeah, we can have debate day in, day out on this, but the truth is, if we're subdued in some way, we're not reaching that higher level of our potential. Absolutely. Do you see that in your educational process with the people that you're in university with?
Yeah, I work with very high achievers. I mean, so I work in, I've been involved with graduate education. So I work with very high achievers. They've all, you know, gone through undergraduate already, but I've also been able to recognize, and again, only a drunk knows a drunk. And right. I've been able to recognize substance abuse in quite a few students. And also I'll tell you that one of my areas of research was actually stress and depression. So I conducted a number of multi-year studies involving that. And that's one of the catalysts is the people mm-hmm. experiences that, you know, stress, anxiety, depression will oftentimes result in more alcohol or drug use. Mm-hmm. And so it's the recognition of that I think, you know, mm-hmm. people need to realize.
Yeah. And we can, go in other directions. There are so many technologies that are also coming available, like TMS, which is mm-hmm. magnetics to stimulate the brain and produce alpha waves. I've had some shows on that as well, because the stress and anxiety and depression has been proven that it's a lower brainwave frequency modulation, that if we do not look at the brain and increase its potential and work with it with therapies that can increase your potential in that way, then we're going to easily go to that, the other voice, the sabotaging voice that's going to say, hey, just have a drink. Hey, just have a smoke. It's okay. Pop a pill. Right. Cause it is, it's an easy way out. Right. Yet it's not getting us to where our soul wants to be. And that inner conflict of the soul's calling versus that human lower level, hey, just get by, mediocrity in the mundane. Whenever we give yes to the mundane and just try to fit in or try to do what's normal or accepted, or mm-hmm. then our soul's crying inside. Our soul's going, damn it, you're here for so much more than this. So, you know, we here are listening today because we know inside of ourselves that there's more. And it's not that I've got to go more to prove myself. I'm going more because I know that's who I am. I know that's what I am brought here to be. I'm doing this not to prove anything to anybody or to, you know, have them recognize that I had the potential. We don't need to prove. Just simply mm-hmm. be. Mm-hmm. What words could you give to us as we listen to your wisdom around that, dear professor?
thank you. I agree with you that when people are when they use substances, a lot of times what happens is that their brain goes to a lower frequency and they're not able to really tap into their inner gifts or tap into their motivation, tap into their potential. And what I have experienced is that I have the ability to really visualize where I could go and be able to conceptualize, you know, the action plans to get there. And, mm-hmm. and of course the hard work that goes with that. And I think that oftentimes substances just takes that out of you. You don't have the ability you don't have the ability to really, galvanize those kinds of gifts. Everybody right. has gifts inside. Everybody has the ability to be so much more. They have the ability to aspire to such a high level. And it's unfortunate I think you mentioned it's about the great deceiver. That's mm-hmm. what happens with that. It just takes it away from you.
Yeah. And it will. This truly is a fight. I mean, if we want to make it biblical or religious or whatever, we can go to that labeling extent. The truth is there is a conflict inside of the human psyche and the human spirit. And it's whether or not we're going to give our energy and time and efforts to that part that's going to keep us down.
Yeah.
and try to become our friend, which is not a true friend. Like you said, is it the enemy? I think of Gollum in The Hobbit, right? he was quite a friendly guy until you go against him, and then he's going to make you feel like poop and turn on you. Or do we give our time and attention and our true heart and soul over to something greater and really move in that direction? We get a choice every single moment, don't we?
Yes, we do.
That's awesome. And so I want to direct everyone to learn more about you and to continue this journey with you, Doctor. And so the website, I had it pulled up. I'm going to go to it. The website that I'd like you to take note of, and then of course, go to bonfirecoaching.com, and we have our episodes there under the podcast. You're going to look for Dr. Scott Massey. And so your website address is just that, drscottmassey.com, DrScottMassey, drscottmassey.com. And there's a lot coming forward from you. I know, I feel it in you. You're just beginning. Your wisdom's going to be pouring forth. And you've written a book, Labyrinth, My Winding Path Through Pain, Loss, and Addiction to a Life of Success and Fulfillment. It is on Amazon. So simply Google or Amazon Dr. Scott Massey, and you'll find his works. Follow Dr. Scott Massey. He's got a lot more to bring to us and enliven us. If you have been and know combating your own internal demons, whatever that shape is, be it an addiction or otherwise, if it's a lack of belief in yourself, like you said, Scott, you know, at the beginning of this, the young version of yourself, that lack of confidence, that self-doubt, the shyness. If you're feeling anxiety, depression, anything that feels like you're not in your essence, and your mind is wanting to reach towards substances or other behaviors that are harming you or others, you know it inside of yourself. We do, right? We don't need to be told because, Scott, you told yourself, I was hiding from other people, but we can sniff it out. We know. And there are people around you that love you. So go seek out sobriety for yourself. Maybe today you're listening to this and you're realizing this is the day. You're going to take this step. You're going to do it. You're either going to get yourself to a meeting. You may not even know what a meeting is. You're going to go Google 12-step meetings in my area. You're going to find and get curious about this, because your next life of wonder, your next becoming is right here at this. And you've got your own foot lamp. This talk today has been a foot lamp to you to see those very next steps. It doesn't need to be an overwhelming vision of grandeur and when life's going to be. Just take one step at a time. It's baby steps, right? Right, Dr. Scott, baby steps will get you to that. Yeah. Any imparting thoughts before we conclude today's wonderful discussion?
What I'd like to say to everybody is that no matter how far you feel like you've fallen, or how desolate things might be, or, you know, wherever you are, you just have to make that decision. And trust me when I say that it's not an easy path, folks, at all. But the blessings of achieving sobriety are so far beyond anybody's comprehension. You're going to be blessed by doing that. And it does take a daily affirmation, a daily decision to be able to maintain that. But if I can do it, I believe that all of you also can as well. And I also am happy to give, and probably these days it's going to be virtual talks, but I'm happy to actually give a free talk to any of you in the audience that might want to engage. So, because again, I want to share this message with everybody. It's part of who I am. And it's something that I feel like I'm compelled to do.
Wonderful. And so if you feel that compelling call inside yourself, so reach out to Dr. Scott Massey. He's here for you. Thank you so much for being our guest here today. Thanks. And thank you for sharing your time and wisdom.
Thank you, Tina Marie. I appreciate it very much.
That was so energizing. I have takeaways that will help my life, and I'm sure you do too. To get show notes, bonuses, gifts for you from our guests, and more, head over to lightyourlifepodcast.com. And be sure to bookmark this podcast as one of your favorites. I am Tina Marie St. Cyr, founder of Bonfire Coaching and creator of the Bonfire Method, Thank you so much for being connected. Now, my homework for you, summon the courage to light your life a little more and go make progress on your dreams today.